particularly the being that is living, the becoming associated with transformation, and the phenomenon, which can be ignored only at great peril and with great effort. Everything alive burns. That is metabolism itself. The burning bush is, therefore, life with the spirit within it, the spirit of being and becoming, the stability and transforming into authentic ultimate form that characterizes everything living. The spirit that lurks behind or makes itself partly known in virtually every encounter with what sparks our interest and compels us forward. The burning bush is the same thing as the living staff of Moses that transforms itself into the serpent of possibility and chaos when called upon to do so. Exodus 4, 2-4, and 7, 10-12, and that of Aaron, which bursts into life when the moment is right. Numbers 17, 8. Moses turns and approaches. He walks away from predictability, away from his current concerns and aims, and into the domain of possibility or potential itself. As he does so, the deeper levels of reality begin to make themselves manifest to him. This is always what happens, to a greater or lesser extent, to those who sincerely and seriously heed what beckons to them. This is the act of coming to consciousness itself. Take, for example, the genuinely committed scientist. Such an individual frequently finds himself irresistibly fascinated by some domain of inquiry, some set of phenomena that calls him forward, and often early in life. The pursuit begins inquiry by inquiry, conversation by conversation, book by book. That interest typically converges on a single point, a specialization, as the now entranced investigator begins legitimately training in the scientific enterprise. The doctoral degree, signifying expertise in a given field of sufficient quality to be regarded as both valid and original, is the conventional marker of such study, successfully undertaken, and the beginning of the narrow but deep pursuit that will characterize the life of the persistent seeker. I wrote my PhD thesis and its associated papers about the problem of male alcoholism, and more specifically, about the response to an acute and intoxicating dose of alcohol. Even more particularly, my research team investigated the effect of such a dose on emotional response, both negative and positive, both baseline, elevation of resting mood, and provoked, reduced anxiety in the face of minor threat. This was very focused research, a tremendous amount of attention, pinpointed on a very specific problem. The research team I was associated with, led by my graduate advisor, Dr. Robert O. Peel, studied males only between the ages of 18 and 24. These subjects had to be social drinkers rather than teetotalers or alcoholics. Their mothers had to be non-alcoholic. Heavy drinking mothers often have children with fetal alcohol syndrome, subtle or fully manifest, and this poses a complication for the causal analysis of the mechanisms of familial transmission. Our all-male subjects also had to have biological fathers, grandfathers, and at least one other first-degree alcoholic relative on the paternal side. What is the old joke? The specialist studies less and less until he ends up knowing absolutely everything about nothing at all. There is some cynical truth to such a criticism, but the opposite is more genuinely true if the restriction of focus is something done in genuine pursuit of the truth. In keeping with this, I soon found that my knowledge broadened tremendously as I made my concern more precise and specific. This speaks to the relationship among aim, attention, and the growth of wisdom. To study alcoholism, I had to study the much more general proclivity to drug abuse and dependence. This meant familiarizing myself, in addition, with the realm of emotion and motivation, including their neurobiological underpinnings, as it is the primary emotional and motivational systems that are affected by drugs typical of abuse. This investigation eventually extended to an analysis of the mechanisms of perception itself. As I approached the target of my inquiry, therefore, what is it about the response to alcohol of someone with a paternal lineage characterized by extensive and severe alcoholism that might differ from the norm and motivate the development of the disorder? My knowledge widened until the one thing I was attending to in great detail began to make its connections with the entire world known. What had I learned about learning itself, in addition to the specific knowledge I obtained during my quest? That those who attend assiduously to their focal narrow concerns will first journey deeper and deeper into the narrowly defined unknown at hand, learning first the details directly relevant to those concerns. But soon after coming to understand the broader webs of associations and causal pathways that are inevitably part of the phenomenon in question. Nothing exists in isolation. Anything studied with sufficient depth, thus, eventually, comes to speak of everything. It is precisely this deepening and broadening that Moses experiences from his encounter with the burning bush. He continues his investigation in all due humility, attending diligently to what is so mysteriously being revealed. Tellingly, he removes his footwear, and God said, "Draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground." Exodus 3:5. What does it mean to approach and then stand upon holy ground, and to do so, moreover, unshod? It means, first, to get close to the bottom of things, to begin to apprehend or understand the foundation of things, to approach the depths or the heights. It means, second, to do so, allowing all the while for transformation of purpose and identity. Shoes signify class, occupation, purpose, role, and destiny. Consider, for example, Cinderella's glass slippers, or the role Dorothy's ruby shoes play in The Wizard of Oz, or the seven-league boots of the European folk tradition, which enabled the wearer to travel great distances with a single step. To remove the current shoes is to abandon the present role, to make contact once again with the ground of being, and to prepare for the next step. To pursue what calls most deeply away from the present and toward that next step is to transform with the calling. The sequential transformation attendant on such calling is the adventure of life, as we saw in the cases of Abram, Sarai, and Jacob. The calling is also the invitation to leadership, as a man so transformed becomes charismatic in his commitment and depth, becomes the man whose actions will be attended to and whose words will be heeded. Moses takes seriously, even devoutly, that which glimmers and glistens and captures his attention. This puts him in touch with the deepest manifestations of the spirit on whose operation the world indeed depends. The Spirit of God calls to Moses from the depths. What does that notion of depth used in such a manner signify? The existence of an intrinsic hierarchy of import. Some things mean more than others. Some things are of a deeper import than others. We understand this intrinsically in the conversational, relational, and literary domains. We can engage with someone else in a shallow or a profound manner. We can have a conversation that is trivial or one that is memorable and moving. Someone with whom we habitually have moving conversations or other deep communicative interactions is someone with whom we have a deep relationship. We see the same thing reflected in the notion of literary depth. Some stories, novels, movies, biographical accounts, are light and trivial. The sort of mere entertainment that requires no effort is satisfying in the short term and has no lasting effect. Some works, by contrast, strike to the heart and change their readers or watchers on some permanent, even revolutionary basis. There is a hierarchy of dependency in presumption of belief, as we indicated in our analysis of the story of the Tower of Babel. Some ideas are shallow. They can be moved, displaced, or even ignored with very little consequence. Others, often those taken for granted, are very deep, which means that very many other ideas depend on them for their continued validity. Consider the issue of depth in a prosaic situation. Imagine a married couple addressing the issue of who does the dishes and who sets the table on a given Saturday evening with dinner guests. It might be hoped that such a negotiation is relatively trivial. Why? Because not much depends on its outcome. Because variance in such outcome, whether it is husband or wife who undertakes one task or the other, is likely to have little effect on the marriage as a whole, past, present, and future. Consider, by contrast, the decision by one party to take one of the dinner guests aside for a wild and sudden sexual encounter, or, even more profoundly, to initiate a continuing affair consisting of a sequence of such encounters. When discovered, such a move is virtually certain to rock the relationship to the foundation, to put all the meaning of the past into question. Who exactly am I married to? To destabilize the present. What exactly is going on here? And to make of the future a threatening, indeterminate chaos. What in the world do we do with each other now? The integrity of the marriage contract, with all its anxiety-reducing and hope-producing or maintaining functions, is not typically called into question by a brief conflict over who takes responsibility for what particular domestic task. Partner fidelity, by contrast, is an axiom of "we take these truths as self-evident" depth. A marriage and all it entails is defined by certain contractual absolutes, and lack of extramarital sexual and emotional involvement is almost inevitably one of them. It is, in fact, in many ways, the defining or central feature of the permanent intimate pairing that makes up marriage as such, or at least one of a mere handful of such central features. It is the core value on which all other values characterizing marriage depend. If fidelity vanishes, everything shakes. That is precisely what defines depth in the psychological and practical sense. The deeper an idea, the more other ideas depend on it. The deeper an axiom of contract or understanding, in other words, the more memories of the past, perceptions of the present, and plans for the future are shaped by it. Thus, the more profound the element of contract, the more anxiety is disinhibited and hope eliminated when betrayal occurs. This is the return of the entropy of the psychophysiological theorists and the great dragon of chaos of the mythological universe. We therefore all approach sacred territory when we descend deeply or ascend profoundly into what calls to us. The sacred is that which moves us when we encounter it, that which, produces awe in its apprehension, that which enlightens, cuts and burns away, and transforms. The transforming power of the depths is identical to the logos that broods upon the deep, separates wheat from chaff and sheep from goats, and turns every which way as gatekeeper to Eden. Moses is instructed to further humble himself as he moves closer to the truth, as he moves closer to contact with the ground of being and becoming itself, and he does so. The place toward which Moses is advancing as he continues in pursuit of what beckons to him becomes increasingly holy as it deepens by definition. Eventually, in the culmination of this part of his adventure, he discovers the same unified spirit that had previously called to his ancestors. Moreover, he said, "I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Exodus 3:6. That continued humility in pursuit of the depths is also the hallmark of the true investigator and adventurer. The willingness to drop all pretensions to knowledge and moral wisdom in pursuit of the truth is the precondition for further enlightenment. This is the equivalent, in abstraction, of the removal of the shoes that signifies acceptance of transformation of identity. Moses has immolated his previous self on the altar of renewal. The divine itself speaks to him out of the ashes. This is the phoenix reborn, whose tears are the medication against the gaze of the paralyzing basilisk. It is precisely those who have honestly pursued what calls to them who get to the bottom of things. It is those who come to understand ever more deeply what lays itself out in front of them. It is such people who are apt to become genuine leaders, to become those to whom others will voluntarily turn, particularly in times of crisis. This is because they have discovered in their truthful pursuit what is necessary to know, but that others refuse to or simply do not yet know. It is the ability to give word to the vagaries of now and to lay out a compelling direction into the future that constitutes leadership and the genuine article, not the counterfeit that uses fear and compulsion. Those who have looked deeply into things become those who speak with the strange and marked authority attributed so frequently to Christ himself, as in the following passage, which follows the Sermon on the Mount. "And it came to pass, when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes." Matthew 7:28 to 29. This sentiment is echoed elsewhere. "And they went into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day he entered into the synagogue and taught. And they were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one that had authority and not as the scribes." Mark 1:21 to 22. Jesus wields the authority of one who has done the work and truly knows. He therefore speaks with the unshakable and undecorated confidence that deadly serious inquiry and complete consequent transformation of idea and character confers. "But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil." Matthew 5:37. It is for such reasons that Moses' destiny as a leader becomes ever more inexorably manifest as his encounter with the burning bush continues. "And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land unto a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites." Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Exodus 3:7-10. The leader is eternally the individual with the fortitude to stand against the tyrant, to speak the words that cannot be resisted, to lead the enslaved through the desert of uncertainty to the promised land. Moses, who has some real humility, does not believe that he is the man for the job. It is frequently the case those dramatically unsuited for power will pursue it for little more than narrowly self-serving and self-aggrandizing reasons. It is a different matter when someone's leadership is requested by those who feel they would be well served by it. And it is a different matter entirely when the transformation attendant on intent seeking produces a character so compelling that leadership now seems destined or preordained. In the final analysis, however, the insufficiencies of ability and defects of character that typify even those who are chosen as spokesmen for the divine are not accepted by God as an excuse for failure to act. What are we to make of this? No more than this. We must all do the best we can with the talents that have been granted to us, and in spite of our multitude of faults, real and imaginary, Moses is therefore enjoined by God to claim his lineage, to proclaim kinship with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to take his place in the continuum of great prophets. And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. And God said, moreover, unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together, and say unto them, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you, and seen that which is done to you in Egypt. Exodus 3:14-16. The true leader must ally himself with the leading spirits of the past. He must come to embody, to stand for, and speak for the same principles that guided those who made the world in the beginning, whether God or man. Otherwise, he becomes the idiot puppet of his own desires or weakness, or, as happens to Aaron, brother of Moses, of the careless whims of the people. Exodus 32:1-35. This standing with the past is the motif of rescuing the father from the belly of the beast. The equivalent is portrayed in recent times in Disney's film Pinocchio, when the marionette frees the good Geppetto from the belly of the whale, from the depths. In The Lion King as well, where the metaphor of what is properly put at the pinnacle is employed instead of what is foundational. The hero of that movie, Simba, has a vision of his father in the sky, assimilated by the sun. The resurrected Mufasa then describes his son's identity and his destiny: to abandon his present state of slavish subjection to his carelessly present-focused adolescent whims, and adopt the responsibility to face the usurping tyrant, Scar, the resentful, evil brother of the king. This vision and voice comes to him at the deepest point of his initial journey downward, something that was in turn both begun and guided by the shaman Rafiki, who uses his living rod of authority to rap Simba on the head to get his attention. It is in this manner that the young lion comes to embody the spirit of the father, as such, which is the benevolent source of all that is good in the particulars of any given father. Simba determines not to invite in the spirit of bitter, murderous resentment who conspires with Cain, as his uncle Scar clearly does. Instead, he determines to open himself up to the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, by definition. In consequence, he lets go of the past, sets his aim upward, gets his house in order, and heads voluntarily for the land of the tyrant for the ultimate confrontation. This is exactly what befalls Moses, or what he invites and enables, in the course of his off-the-beaten-track encounter with the burning bush. Such stories indicate and insist, as well, that the true leader is also not a revolutionary. He is instead someone who reestablishes the genuine covenant or contract that has always guided mankind. He is instead someone who brings his spirit into alignment with what has always been great. He is, therefore, someone who renews rather than someone who shatters and then too radically and hubristically reshapes. Someone who can identify and reserve what is truly nourishing and offer it once again for mass consumption. Such a figure only has a revolutionary mien when the society against which he is standing has forgotten so much and become so corrupt that the good now makes itself manifest as a shocking revelation. It is in all these manners that the genuine leader comes to speak with the eternal voice of the great Father and to offer the bread and water that satisfies all hunger and slakes all thirst. He is also the man who leads his people from tyranny and slavery, albeit through the desert, to the promised land. Such tyranny and slavery can and does exist at every level of the psychological and social hierarchy. We tyrannize ourselves and are the craven servants of our own desires. We kowtow to or tyrannize over our wives, husbands, children, siblings, and friends. We set up our enterprises so that we can exercise power over the slaves we hire and exploit. We seek political office so that the influence we crave can be brought to serve the narrow self-interests that possess us. True leadership, true character, more deeply, always and everywhere means opposition to the tyrant and the slave, and more deeply, to the spirits that animate both. Such movement away from the enticements of power and subjection is, eternally, the journey to the promised land. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt, unto the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites, and the Amorites and the Perizzites, and the Hivites and the Jebusites, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. Exodus 3:17. God defines himself in his pronouncement to Moses as the principle of being and becoming itself. There is substantive disagreement about the meaning of the Hebrew phrase contained within the story, in part because of its indeterminacy regarding time. However, all of its various potentially valid interpretations serve to flesh out the character in question, the one who says, "I am who I am. I will become what I choose to become. I am the one who exists. I am the being. I will become whatever I please. I create whatever I create," or, "I will be what I will be." Even who is more complex than a single translation might indicate. The meaning of the Hebrew word azer is context dependent and can be read as that, which, and where. All this variation is perhaps accurately understood as an appropriately multidimensional characterization of the ultimate bedrock of reality. That bedrock cannot be mere being, as what is constantly changes and transmutes. Neither can it be mere random becoming, as the future is constrained by the past, enough so that a certain degree of predictability inevitably and blessedly reigns, sometimes and with some things more than others. God presents himself, arguably, as the spirit behind both being and becoming, as the spirit of divine creativity itself, as the ultimate ground of reality, as that which is behind mere appearance, whether of past, present, or future, as that which is immutable across the flow of time. Along with this description or revelation comes the insistence that those who do not bow down to this ultimate principle will suffer or be destroyed, or worse, regardless of their earthly status, and that the proper state is the one ruled by respect for and fidelity to what is most real. Thomas Aquinas conceived of the universe in keeping with this formulation as a series of stepping stones arranged in ascending order from lowest to highest, shades of Jacob's ladder, at once crowned and created by God. Matter manifests itself in form. Existence, that is, human experience, plays out the possibility of essence. God, by definition and by self-definition in the book of Exodus, is the underlying union of the two. God, the actus purus, is the pattern of action that is necessarily reflected by any given act that makes that act an act. The perfection that makes all things that reflect perfection possible, not least all things beautiful, the being and becoming that is in common to all things that exist and emerge. Perhaps a musical analogy might be helpful. Every piece of music shares something in common, which might be regarded as the principle or spirit of music. Every manifestation of this spirit makes itself known in a given musical work that, when played, has a certain predictability and constancy, as well as a certain element of surprise. Each composition is thus a manifestation of the balance between being or order and becoming and chaos, and, simultaneously, a manifestation of the deeper principle that eternally allows those two domains to play. Each musical piece also fleshes out or gives form to one element of the universe of potential musical forms. That universe is also a kind of reality, a kind of heavenly or implicit reality, the reality of possible forms, reflecting the full range of variation that defines music itself. The cosmos, likewise, unfolds according to a set of principles that, if finally non-contradictory, mutually commensurate, and supporting, reflect an ultimate principle. The intuition of this idea drives the continual scientific striving for a grand unified theory, free of internal contradictions. Such aim also defines the cultural endeavor, broadly speaking, the bringing together that is a necessary precondition to any social organization at any level, family, community, city, state. This is something very much akin to the drive toward a pathologically integrating ideology or meta-narrative, in the worst case, or an increasingly valid and productive unifying monotheism. How could the world be any other way? How could reality be a plurality without dissolving continually into an impossible warring chaos? How could any pathway be forged forward in the presence of a fundamental disintegration? Furthermore, and equally, how could adaptation to reality require anything other than the deepest alignment or even embodiment of the deepest unifying principle of reality? If what is eternal and unchanging, and therefore most reliable, is the proper bedrock, and it is by definition, then what transmutes in time or place cannot be properly regarded as what is most real. Thus, it will also be necessary in times of trouble to return to the foundation. Granted, it is no simple matter to determine what remains constant across the endless transformations of life, but it is clearly the case that a certain central constancy allows both for the maintenance of direction toward that constancy and the constraint of anxiety, which is a condition that manifests itself as a consequence of unforeseen change. We want constancy in what is crucial from our wives or husbands, our children, our friends, and from the world itself. We cannot be oriented without that central constancy. It is in keeping with this that the first of the three responses given by God to Moses also implies a statement of incomparability, I am without equal, and a covenant, I will be with you. 7.3, return to the tyrannical kingdom. God warns Moses that the Pharaoh will not easily accede to the demand for freedom. He will instead double down, as is the wont of tyrants. God also tells Moses that the reward of passing through the evil king's trials will be magnified, even by the fact of the latter's inevitable intransigence. There is more than a hint here that forthright resistance in the face of severe opposition may well turn the tide. It is even possible to imagine that the fact of the Pharaoh's resistance is a great benefit to Moses, and that the opposition faced by the prophet does nothing in the final analysis, or all things considered, but redound to his benefit and that of his people. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall come to pass that when you go, you shall not go empty, but every woman shall borrow of her neighbor and of her that sojourneth in her house jewels of silver and jewels of gold and raiment. And ye shall put them on your sons and upon your daughters, and ye shall spoil the Egyptians. Exodus 3, 21 to 22. It is, of course, the most ancient idea that the treasure eternally sought by the hero is guarded by a terrible dragon. Sometimes, perhaps, the treasure is obvious and the dragon lurking. The reverse should be equally true. When a dragon appears, there is treasure to be found somewhere if enough care is taken to look and enough faith manifested to make the search possible. This is a very good thing to understand in times of trouble. The text describing the despoiling of the Egyptians makes an analogous point. When a society becomes tyrannical and turns to evil, it will leave all of its true treasures on the table, available for those who determine no longer to be slaves to take to themselves. Thus, when the tyrannical state turns away from the highest and proper aim, those that inhabit it can no longer distinguish truth from falsehood, justice from betrayal, the beautiful from the hideous, or the valuable from the utterly worthless. When the state has given itself over entirely to the lie, what is left for the faithful is, self-evidently, all that is true and good. This means that the great value constituted by those virtues can be gathered by those who desire to move forward and to be free. Free, that is, in the manner that true freedom must necessarily be conceptualized. This is not the hedonistic anarchy of immaturity, but the ordered freedom of the properly sacrificing and mature, the celebration or worship of God in the desert that Moses offers to the captive Israelites as the alternative to the tyranny of Egypt and to slavery itself. God warns his nascent prophet that the Pharaoh will prove a tough nut to crack, given his arrogance and power. He therefore grants to Moses the ability to perform magic, most notably with the crook, rod, or pointer his servant has heretofore used to guide his flocks. He instructs Moses to cast that trusty walking stick to the ground, where it became a serpent, and Moses fled from before it. And the Lord said unto Moses, put forth thine hand and take it by the tail. And he put forth his hand and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. Exodus 4, 3 to 4. This act places Moses in the role of arbiter of order, signified by the staff, which is something to rest or rely on, something that guides proper following or conduct, as when used to correct the actions of a wayward lamb. His staff is as well transmuted into the agent of transformation and renewal. Thus, he can take what can be leaned on, what is solid, what can be used for guidance and support, and turn it into what is chaotic, subtle, hidden, dangerous, fluid, and transmutes. This makes Moses the master of the serpent-slash-tree dynamic that is equivalent to the burning bush, transformation in the midst of living order, and the essence of the trees that stand in the midst of the eternal garden. Tellingly, God instructs Moses to engender the process of transformation in the manner that is most dangerous and that therefore requires the highest degree of faith. He is commanded to seize the serpent not by the head, which is clearly the safe thing to do, insofar as there is any safe way to grab a potentially poisonous snake, but by the tail. This is part of the insistence throughout Exodus that redemption is found through continual voluntary exposure to that which is threatening. This staff or rod of Moses represents a continuation of the extremely ancient and foundational idea of the cosmic center. Mircea Eliade comments on the importance of the pole that signifies the center to a tribal group of the original inhabitants of Australia. According to the traditions of an Arunta tribe, the Achilpa, in mythical times, the divine being Numbakula cosmicized their future territory, created their ancestor, and established their institutions. From the trunk of a gum tree, Numbakula fashioned the sacred pole, Kawa Awa, and, after anointing it with blood, climbed it and disappeared into the sky. This pole represents a cosmic axis, for it is around the sacred pole that territory becomes habitable, hence is transformed into a world. The sacred pole consequently plays an important role ritually. During their wanderings, the Achilpa always carry it with them and choose the direction they are to take by the direction toward which it bends. This allows them, while being continually on the move, to be always in their world and, at the same time, in communication with the sky into which Numbakula vanished. For the pole to be broken denotes catastrophe. It is like the end of the world, reversion to chaos. Spencer and Gillen report that once, when the pole was broken, the entire clan were in consternation. They wandered about aimlessly for a time and finally lay down on the ground together and waited for death to overtake them. This staff or rod that defines the center is another representation of Jacob's ladder, or the holy mountain that unites heaven and earth. It is the tree that the ancient shamans climbed in their ritual attempts to attain the wisdom of the gods. It is the cosmic axis that stretches upward to the North Star, around which the entire visible cosmos rotates, and that has been used since time immemorial as a means of orientation and navigation. It is the beanstalk of Jack and the Beanstalk, a pillar that reaches up to the land of the giant, where the greatest of all possible treasures is held. It is the ideal around which all perception of all things is organized, on which even the margin depends for its existence, protected as it is by that center, that ideal, however invisibly, from the chaos that sweeps everything away. It is the midst of the city, the point of a ziggurat or pyramid, the dome of a cathedral, the spire of a church. It is the stabilizing effect of the spirit of the ancients on what could all too rapidly become the demented consensus of the present, its importance cannot be overstated. It is the traditional indicator and representative of the cosmic order itself. From Iliada. Until their conversion to Christianity, the Celts and Germans still maintained their worship of such sacred pillars. The same cosmological image is found not only among the Romans and in ancient India, where we hear of the Skamba, the cosmic pillar, but also among the Canary Islanders, and in such distant cultures as those of the Quacayutl and the Nada of Flores Island. The Quacayutl believe that a copper pole passes through the three cosmic levels. The point at which it enters the sky is the door to the world above. The work of the gods, the universe, is repeated and imitated by men on their own scale. The Axis Mundi, seen in the sky in the form of the Milky Way, appears in the ceremonial house in the form of a sacred pole. It is the trunk of a cedar tree, 30 to 35 feet high, over half of which projects through the roof. This pillar plays a primary part in the ceremonies. It confers a cosmic structure on the house. In the ritual songs, the house is called Our World, and the candidates for initiation who live in it proclaim, I am at the center of the world, I am at the post of the world, and so on. The same assimilation of the cosmic pillar to the sacred pole and of the ceremonial house to the universe is found among the Nada of Flores Island. The sacrificial pole is called the pole of heaven and is believed to support the sky. In keeping with this provision of word and artful play, God gives Moses the ability to perform other miracles. And the Lord said furthermore unto him, put now thine hand into thy bosom. And he put his hand into his bosom. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous as snow. And he said, put thine hand into thy bosom again. And he put his hand into his bosom again and plucked it out of his bosom. And behold, it was turned again as his other flesh. Exodus 4, 6 to 7. Moses is granted the ability to play at the interface between sickness and health. This is in keeping with the rod/snake symbolism. The staff or rod of Asclepius, a Greek example, is the almost universal symbol of the medical profession. The physician Galen, one of the most accomplished medical researchers of antiquity, specifically associated the Asclepian rod with the staff/serpent of Moses. The serpent is placed on the staff because it is a creature that is very long-lived and very healthy, and because it is said to have the power to renew its youth by casting its skin. The staff represents the support that Asclepius gives to those who are sick, and the serpent represents the power of healing that he possesses. The staff of Asclepius is derived from the brazen serpent that Moses made and which was placed on a pole in the desert. The Israelites who looked at the brazen serpent were cured of the bites of the serpents that God had sent to punish them. We will return to the serpent/staff motif later. Suffice it to say for now that finally, Moses is granted the ability to transform water into blood, the very stuff of life. And it shall come to pass, if they will not believe also these two signs, neither hearken unto thy voice, that thou shalt take of the water of the river and pour it upon the dry land, and the water which thou takest out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land. Exodus 4:9. This third miracle establishes the pattern. One is a fluke, two is suggestive, and three is rhetorically convincing, memorable. Perhaps because three repetitions takes the observer out of the realm of ignorable randomness and chance. This means that Moses has been given compelling proof of the magic he might wield if he chooses the path of the leader. Nonetheless, despite his direct experience of the depth and the magic at hand, he remains uncertain, beset by doubt. This is another response that should arouse sympathy rather than the judgment that castigates in the imagination of the astute and careful reader. We would all like to think that if faced directly with a miracle, or two, or three, we would immediately become resolute and implacable in all things, would become upward-aiming and devout followers of God. We are simply not that faithful, however, being instead just as stubborn and hard of heart as the Pharaoh, just as likely to stick to our tyranny in whatever domain of power we have managed to establish, however trivial and small scale it might be. If, in all our corrupt striving, we have not managed to ensnare some innocent others, we can at least tyrannize our petty, subjective selves, rejecting information that would be inconvenient to assimilate, however necessary it might be, to save the sanity of those around us and to protect our equally vulnerable future selves. It should therefore be easy to have some sympathy for Moses and his doubt. The would-be prophet is still concerned that neither the Egyptians nor the Israelites will find anything he says remotely credible, much less compelling enough to produce a social transformation. He expresses his doubt, starting in all humility, or perhaps in fear, with his reservations about himself. And Moses said unto the Lord, "O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore, nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue." Exodus 4:10. It is unsurprising that a man of limited rhetorical gifts harbors misgivings about his prospects as a leader. How can you lead when your capacity to communicate is questionable? It might well be objected, however, as God almost immediately does, that the chosen prophet is overestimating the necessity in leadership for glib fluency and underestimating the impact of the divine truth, however haltingly uttered. This is in addition to the aforementioned fact that there is no valid excuse for failing to move forward when we are called to, regardless of our personal shortcomings or faults. God therefore reprimands Moses for his lack of faith, or encourages him, depending on your point of view. "And the Lord said unto him, Who hath made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb, or deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have I not the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with thy mouth, and teach thee what thou shalt say." Exodus 4:11-12. What does it mean to speak with the words of God? Have we not all met people who perhaps do not say too much, but whose gravitas, depth, and sincerity are such that all who hear, listen, and consider? The divine reveals to Moses another truth. No one could or should do what the now specified leader of the Israelites will be attempting, the undertaking of the grand adventure of his life, alone. Even though Moses has been chosen by God to lead, there is plenty left for everyone else to do, just as there was, for example, for Lot, Sarai, and the other allies and compatriots of Abram. God therefore tells Moses to ally himself with his brother, Aaron, who has the gift of a golden tongue. "Is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well. And also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee. And when he seeth thee, he will be glad in his heart. And thou shalt speak unto him, and put words in his mouth. And I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what ye shall do. And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people. And he shall be, even he shall be to thee instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of God. Exodus 4, 14 to 16. Aaron, who becomes the political arm of Moses and his mission, has his place as much as his more divinely connected brother, and a place which, if occupied to the utmost, would become as important as the role played by Moses himself. The world is apparently constituted such that each participant in it could and should play a central role. Thus, all would-be saviors, including those who are genuine, must realize that every other person also has a cross to bear and world to redeem. We are all charged with the necessity to do the best we can, no matter what, with all the talents granted to us, in spite of our multitude of faults, whether real or imaginary. We must as well ally ourselves with people we can trust and who bring to the table what we know we lack, so that we can properly shoulder our full responsibility in concert with all upward-aiming others. There is thus more than enough for everyone to do while journeying together toward the promised land. To put it another way, the great adventure of any one person does not interfere with the equally great potential adventure of all others. Instead, exemplary action on the part of one does nothing but increase the opportunity of others. The world we inhabit is no mere zero-sum game. The tohu vabohu that surrounds us and out of which order constantly emerges is instead vast enough so that there is plenty to go around and more than enough room for all. In my Father's house are many mansions, Christ tells his disciples, John 14:2, indicating with deadly precision the inexhaustible quality of the properly established heavenly order. Moses is therefore commanded by God to take up his mantle, enjoined to claim his lineage, to accept his kinship with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to take his place in the continuum of great prophets. And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. And God said moreover unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say unto them, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen that which is done to you in Egypt. Exodus 3, 14 to 16. This sharing by Aaron of the burden of Moses is our first indication of the principle of subsidiarity. That is the distribution of responsibility down the social hierarchy to every level of community, married couple, family, town, state, and nation. That is the only genuinely viable alternative to the stony prison of tyranny or crimson chaos and desert. The only true replacement for the king constantly clamored for by the irresponsible people of Israel, Samuel 1:8, but who also poses the most serious of dangers to their true psychological and social maturity and integrity. 7.4, back to the land of doubling down. With the details now arranged and his support staff in hand, both in the form of magic rod and Aaron, Moses agrees to return to Egypt. God warns him of the difficulty awaiting. And the Lord said unto Moses, when thou goest to return into Egypt, see that thou do all those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thine hand, but I will harden his heart that he shall not let the people go. Exodus 4:21. Further, this kingly resistance will be severe. And thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn. Exodus 4:23. It is, of course, paradoxical that the very God who is commanding Moses to confront the Pharaoh and lead his enslaved people to freedom is the same force that is simultaneously hardening the heart of the tyrant. The authors of this account refused to shy away from the complex oppositions inherent in life. A monotheistic and all-powerful God is behind everything that happens. The mere fact that this omnipresence is not always comprehensible to human beings, given their limited scope of apprehension, does not eliminate the necessity of attributing to God all authority, including that which seems to run counter to his character as currently understood. The tendency of the tyrant's heart to harden when challenged appears to be part of the intrinsic nature of being, and therefore something attributable in the final analysis to God, given the high probability of that occurrence and the persistence of the trait across time. Why that might be is an important question to answer, but admitting that it is the case is equally important and might even be the precursor to answering the question of why. We might speculate, poetically or metaphorically, does eternal justice dictate that the punishment must fit the crime? If so, those who have persisted in their malfeasance and have therefore set themselves up to deserve harsher recrimination are also of their own accord more prone to stick stubbornly to their misbehavior when challenged, or even to further instantiate that very stubbornness in the face of challenge rather than to admit to error and change. Is it not in the very nature of tyranny to respond to correction with ever more insistent refusal? It is for this reason that the tyrant doubles down, for this reason that he is symbolically allied with the kingdom of stone, and the Savior who redeems and transforms associated, by contrast, with the living water. From the Tao Te Ching, there is nothing more yielding than water. Yet when acting on the solid and strong, its gentleness and fluidity have no equal in anything. The weak can overcome the strong, and the supple overcome the hard. Although this is known far and wide, few put it into practice in their lives. Although seemingly paradoxical, the person who takes upon himself the people's humiliation is fit to rule, and he is fit to lead who takes the country's disasters upon himself. After his encounter with the burning bush, after receiving the revelations thus imparted, Moses informs his father-in-law, Jethro, of his intention to return to Egypt with his wife and sons, and departs with his blessing. They all sojourn, along with Moses' brother, back to the kingdom of the Pharaoh, where Aaron relates what has transpired to the Israelites. The strength of his words, the accompanying signs performed by Moses, and the oppressed Israelites' fundamental desire for salvation work together to convince the people that the time for their freedom has come. Moses meets with the Pharaoh and utters, for the first time, the famous line, "Let my people go." Exodus 5:1. But that is not all he says. The remainder is not only equally relevant, the very meaning of the first section depends upon it. Moses says more completely, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness." Exodus 5:1. This means, first, that this is not a request from Moses, which can be easily ignored, given that it derives from one relatively powerless man, but from the source of being and becoming itself. Second, that freedom and the cessation of tyranny is intrinsically desired, at least by those who wrestle with God. And third, and most easily and conveniently overlooked, that such freedom is to be given not even for the virtue of freedom in and of itself, but so that the people so freed can hold a feast unto God in the wilderness. Alternative versions put it this way: let my people go so that they may hold a festival in my honor in the wilderness. New Living Translation. Let my people go so that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. New American Standard Bible. Let my people go into the desert so they can honor me with a celebration there. Contemporary English Version. Let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. Douay-Rheims Bible. Let my people go so they may make a pilgrimage for me in the desert. International Standard Version. It is worthwhile attending to the similarities and the differences across these interpretations to get the story straight. And that story is this. God is calling on the Pharaoh through Moses to free the Israelites and on the Israelites to claim the right to and responsibility for that freedom, not so they can be free in some absolute sense, but so that they can sojourn from tyranny into the wilderness and organize themselves there in a celebratory pilgrimage dedicated to God. This is a freedom organized under the rubric of the highest possible good, a continual pilgrimage to the highest possible place, a celebration of sacrifice, truth, adventure, wise caution, courage, all the virtues that have already been deemed characteristic of God himself and demanded of his true followers. This command or injunction is repeated no fewer than 7 times in the text, a repetition obviously designed to ensure that the full point is not missed. Exodus 5:1, 7:16, 8:1, 8:20, 9:1, 9:13, 10:3. This is no different than the upward sacrifice of Abraham that accompanies movement along the pathway of adventure, or the offering that is required of Jacob, then Israel, as he climbs the ladder toward the divine. This is the same thing, in the broadest sense, as the maturation that turns all those who would otherwise remain Peter Pans or worse into true men of God. It is forever tempting to assume that the demise of an arbitrary tyranny will immediately be followed by the establishment of a paradise of unrestricted freedom. And it is a great convenience to ignore the accompanying insistence by God that the sojourn into freedom is to be a celebration of that which is properly put in the highest place. But that is nonetheless the command. And Moses repeats it in the many subsequent meetings he has with the increasingly intractable king of Egypt to ensure there is no misunderstanding. The clarion call of Moses to freedom, eternally away from tyranny and slavery, is most decidedly not a call to anarchy or hedonism, but an invitation to the voluntary discipline striving upward that was most truly echoed by the writers of the U.S. Declaration of Independence when they insisted that the sovereign individuals who make up a free state have the right to pursue happiness. For a mature and well-constituted people, this is not a call to self-gratification and to hell with the future and everyone else. It is the pursuit of a higher harmony of self and other, now and later, that constitutes the proper celebration in what would otherwise be a wasteland. The inspired repetition of Moses with regard to that point is an indication of the difficulty of the lesson and the depth of the immature wish for the untrammeled false freedom or the anarchy of immediate gratification of equally immediate desire. The calling on the people of Israel to organize themselves maturely in proper celebration is another early hint toward the idea of subsidiarity, which allows the ordered freedom that exists when individual psyche and society alike are organized in a harmonious hierarchy, with everything and everyone in the proper place up and down the ranks. That is, first, a hierarchy of responsibility and voluntarily undertaken responsibility at that. And second, a structure with something at its pinnacle to unite it. Otherwise, there is no harmony. That uniting ultimate pinnacle is, by definition, the Spirit of God. The very name of Yahweh is derived from the description of the principle of being itself, Heya, and has as its core the same ambivalence or comprehensiveness as the description that emerges from the midst of the burning bush. I am what I am, or I will be what I will be. Subsidiarity works when each individual, married couple, family, local community, state, and nation bears the duties or has the meaningful adventure appropriate to their position. If that responsibility is properly distributed and voluntarily and effectively borne, the bearers free themselves from the shackles of their slavish habits and keep for themselves the authority and freedom of choice that the tyrant will otherwise appropriate. A self-governing people do not require a king. Alternatively, all abdicated responsibility will be taken up by the power mad and used against those slavish enough to reject their calling and conscience. It might be noted as well, with regard to the notions both of ultimate and ineffable that are intrinsically associated with the divine pinnacle, just as the pillars of light and dark that later guide the Israelites keeps its leading distance as the chosen people move forward, what is at the top of the striving forward of those aiming at God recedes as it is approached. This means, not least, that the goodness of God is inexhaustible and that new vistas of promise and perfection still beckon even as the promised land nears, even after it is established, at least insofar as that is possible, on earth. The Pharaoh rejects Moses' entreaty, voicing his disbelief in the existence of the Lord, noting his countrymen's dependence on the labor of the Israelites, and, to top it off, just because he can, spitefully heaping an additional set of arduous tasks upon them. And Pharaoh commanded the same day the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, "Ye shall no more give the people straw to make brick as heretofore. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. And the tail of the bricks which they did make heretofore, ye shall lay upon them. Ye shall not diminish aught thereof. For they be idle, therefore they cry, saying, Let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let there more work be laid upon the men, that they may labor therein, and let them not regard vain words." Exodus 5:6-9. This response demoralizes Moses. He takes up the case with God, pointing out that his efforts in delivering the call for freedom from on high has done nothing but increase the burden borne by his fellow Israelites. This is an allusion to the cost of the truth. Just as people lie so that comfort, however false, remains intact in the present, or so that they positively gain something undeserved, the revelation of the truth often makes things worse, however temporarily, as what is not right but has previously escaped attention is perceived, And as the powers that be, psychological or social, refuse to budge, punish the messenger, and double down. God reassures his prophet, telling him that things will work out even better because of the Pharaoh's stubborn resistance, and instructs him to organize his people into ancestral groups as a prerequisite to their new organization as a free state. If ethical action and honest speech always produced immediate benefit, no one would be tempted to shirk responsibility or lie. People are tempted to wander off the righteous path, so to speak, precisely because doing so often produces the immediate consequences desired. Just because something works well now